a mountainside near the asylum in the ghost town of Jerome, Arizona. You are listening to Jerry and Kathy Wills.
You don't know why.
Comments and views expressed on the Jerry Wills Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect those of Jerry Wills, the Jerry Wills Show, the affiliates or sponsors, or Channel U.
Sound back on. There we go. Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a great evening tonight. We're a little late in starting. Got a weird thing going on with the control board. I have usually no sound from my own voice going into my own headphones a microsecond later. So it's really hard to talk when you've got that going on. I couldn't resolve it. So I'll be stuttering a bit, I'm sure, as we go through the evening. But we do have a really fantastic show for you. Our guest tonight is Robert Kreider from Kreider Exploration. And we've been following Robert for quite some time. He's been following us as well. We finally met up in Tucumcari, New Mexico, and spent nearly 6 hours just sitting there chatting, talking, one thing after the other. Time blew past like it was nothing. And we covered a lot of territory, and we realized there's a lot more territory to cover. I wish you could have been a fly on the wall to have heard and been a part of that, because it really was just an extraordinary first meeting. This is a very honest, very intelligent fellow. And all I can say is I'm so impressed with the information and the effort he's put into what he's doing. There is a story here, a very complicated story, and it goes off in many different directions. It isn't just about ancient civilizations. It isn't just about UFOs, Bigfoot, paranormal. It's about all of it, and even more than that. So I'm going to bring Robert on. And I think it's better if Robert just tells you the story about himself instead of me trying to give you some lead-in with, trying to tell you who he is and what he's all about. I think the best person to do that would be Robert himself. What I'm interested in knowing, and I'm sure other people are too, how did you get started in this?
Well, I've had a life of odd experiences and encounters. It started when I was a really young child. And really, it was related to me that on the way home, even from the hospital, there was red balls of light dancing around the mountain we lived on, when we pulled up in the forest there. And then I guess my first experience with a UFO, which I actually remember a little bit of it. I remember being seeing something weird in the sky and being rushed into the house, and I was 11 months old at that time. My mother later related to me. And then, throughout my younger childhood, I actually had quite a bit of what you'd call, I guess, interference even with alien type entities and such, and, visiting the house or whatever. And I remember I even had, when I was like 5 years old, I even had my mom make a muslin set of window dressings that even light wouldn't go through. During the daylight, when they were closed at night, I wanted to know that they were black. So even at night or in the daylight, we would close them and try to get light through them to make sure, because there was always something. I remember at my window on the second story of the house, which used to wig me out pretty bad. And my parents never took it too serious, and I didn't really either. And then I didn't know it was that unusual being a small child. And as I matured through life, I found out how unusual that was, you know. But I mean, I even remember seeing a couple of discs and long cylindrical craft. By the time I was like 6-7 years old, I'd already seen 3 or 4. Once I had vanished for a few hours during an afternoon, and when they finally found me, I was only about a block away, standing in a field, and I had been in the backyard, so what they say. I was real young then, so I don't remember too much, but I do remember when they found me looking up, and when they got there, I was staring up at a craft that you could say, call it was a disc, but it was actually more stubbier, you know. It was taller than, almost as tall as it was wide, and it had what looked like panels, and it was rotating. And so it just kind of went on for there. And you know, I saw some early shows like In Search of and stuff with Leonard Nimoy back in the day, I think it's 75 or whatever, on Bigfoot. And they covered some other pretty weird genre and aspects. And I knew there was a reality to it because, of course, from a young age, I had already experienced quite a bit of strange things. And I thought that was the normal world. And then as they produce these shows that come across as here's the unusual, and then we grew up in school and they failed to teach any of this or relate any of it, and this is the things I wanted to see as I grew up taught to me, and so that basically built up a will and a want to go find these truths and lay them out for everyone to see, because obviously they weren't being shown to us. And that basically, that's kind of how it all started anyway.
That's pretty wild. What years were these and where were you?
Well, I was born in 65, so by 70, I was already experiencing, you know, and cognitive of the strangeness. And by 75, of course, you know, I'm 10 years old by the time that In Search of is rolling the Bigfoot stuff out, and I'd already heard stories and things like that. And then as it went up through the years, you know, of course, I did the whole high school thing, and we were too busy going to the beach and getting in trouble to pay much attention. And when that all, when my oats wore off, so to speak, a little bit, in the mid to late 80s, then I really actually started on the ground, boots on the ground, going and taking a look for ourselves, you know. So, and that actually started a lot of that north of Black Canyon City and around that area, north of Phoenix there.
Oh, no kidding. So it's right around where we are right now.
Yeah. Matter of fact, 8 miles east of you is, we actually went back in there because all the old miners, there's a whole generation now that's been lost. But when I first got in there, that place was still pretty wild. And some of the old miners were still active and around there and just told us, don't ever go back in those canyons, you'll die. And that was pretty much enough invitation for us. But another guy I trusted a whole lot, who was a mining engineer, and worked superstitions and told me some real strange stuff they found. And he told me, he says, you go back there. He said, I know you guys will make it. He said, but what's at the back there? You're going to flip out. I'm not going to say a word, but you'll discover it. So I guess it was, they had known about it. But that ended up being Coronado's winter home. Yeah. So, and it's tucked back in there enough to where you could even tell people about it. And there's a handful in 100 who would ever even make it there, you know. So it's so rugged.
Wow. And is that east of the 17 or west of the 17?
East.
Okay. So you were, yes, that's the Bradshaw Mountains.
Yeah. It's a piece of parts of it. It's actually like Sunset Mesa is the edge of that escarpment that's north of the town there. And that, mm-hmm. that escarpment goes all the way up Agua Fria Canyon and it's back in there. But the, you know, Arizona State University, we found a chalice that had the crest of Coronado, one of their family chalices. And it originally was from probably the 1520s, they said. And, but we actually took that to ASU and they were a little bit rude about it. We wanted to establish some cooperation and reveal the location. They just wanted the location and to keep the artifact, but not do an exchange of any information or open that door so we could be part of it. So we just kind of got it back and left. But yeah, there was about 8 miles of constructed Roman style road, but it was all taken out with landslides and severe floods and stuff, you know, over the past. But so what happened was, though, everyone thinks they turned up the Verde Valley and then went on to Zuni. Into the White Mountains and then on to Zuni. And so everyone takes all their full historical account of that. And really, they didn't do that. They went all the way to Black Canyon City. And the ruins there in the north, those ruins all had implements of gold. I mean, that's the edge of what they call the Golden Triangle, the richest surface gold area in the United States, even Alaska. And And so, but all the utensils and everything were made of gold in those seven ruins, and that's where they ate the Black Moor, Esteban. And when I say, when people go, oh, what do you mean ate? Well, the Apache there told me, who were the relatives of those who lived in those dwellings, that when they showed up, sure, everything they had was gold, because it was easy to get, easy to work. And they could trade it with all the groups coming from down south and became quite rich. But anyway, when Esteban got up there, they saw him as a spy, and he basically was a jerk. I mean, his whole procession ahead of Coronado, he was not doing good things. But he only made it that far. So the Apache there said, nope, you're a jerk, and they ate him. And I said, why'd you guys eat him? And he said, well, to gain his secrets, because we knew he was dishonest and we wanted to know what he was hiding. And but anyway, when Coronado got to there, they actually turned east, and not up the Agua Fria Canyon because it's just too rough, but just south of it, less than a mile, they actually constructed a large road to access the higher plains up there, and then that goes all the way into Verde Valley. And on that access is where they ran across some ancient predating mines that were mined in prehistory, who knows by who, and because they are tunnels. And then he set in his winter home there and just didn't tell anyone about the location. So everyone turns toward the up toward the Zuni early. And then actually the first settlers of Black Canyon City said that there used to be three stone crosses directly to the east of town there, up on the hill, and that they'd only been removed maybe in the 30s or 40s. And if you read the original writs, you know, about the Coronado trip, well, they erected three stone crosses where they turned east. So in that missing wedge there, because everyone turns east up the Verde Valley, they never go north. So in that entire area, there's where Coronado had all of his main activity. And it's like supposedly been, you know, lost in time, that whole era. So.
Wow. And we're living here.
Yep. Yeah, you're there. All the way around you is just really cool stuff. So it used to be my stomping ground, so.
Yeah, well, Kathy's been saying for a long time, there's all kinds of stuff here. She just knows it. And, you know, you take a look at those mountains, they're just rough as hell. We've been up into them a little bit, but not, you know, to the extent that you have. And it's really, really rough terrain to navigate.
Yeah, some of the roughest in the world, actually. And then I've seen temperature at the wrecking yard at the mouth of the Agua Fria Canyon at 137 degrees in the shade under their pole barn, and even hotter in the sun. So when you get back in those canyons, are just black and they're like a big parabolic. That's why they you know, the old miners said, hey, don't go back in there. If you go back in those canyons, you'll die. You know, they'll just cook you to jerky. But of course, you know, there's always ways of doing everything. So,
wow, pretty amazing. So it sounds like you found some pretty interesting things back in there. And this is where your inception was for going looking for ancient things, you know, treasure, ancient knowledge. What was it you were looking for? Just anything in particular?
Well, we didn't know what that stuff was back there. And then it took a little bit of time. I started to find name dates that looked wrong, you know, just inconsistencies and things in the surrounding canyons. And I actually found what now we know as a cache site from their activity hidden in there, but I didn't know what it was at the time. But yeah, basically breaking down and looking for encoded information, because we already knew where the site was. Now what, how did they mark it and hide it, and what did they mark that leads you to that? So kind of a reverse engineering method on that first one. Mm-hmm. And then it grew from there. I mean, really, exponentially once I moved to New Mexico, then things got real hot.
And what took you to New Mexico?
No, I just had a plan. I had lived here as when I was younger in the 84, 85. And actually my family was all from here. They homesteaded like 15,000 acres of ranch land and almost that much mountainous terrain, and, you know, put in all the roads and basically around more in northern New Mexico up there. And so I had family heritage here with a lot of in-depth story and history. And just, there was one little town that I just knew. I knew in my 20s, that's where I'd end up. So a little bitty hole in the wall named San Juan. So we went to there in 91, and then by 94 began to find and make leaps and bounds on discovery and understanding. So. And it was, of course, this area that I'm in now is basically a focal point of global activity that no one that was here doing anything had any interest in really telling anybody about it except their own groups or you know, organizations or whatever.
Yeah, we've spoken to, you know, a number of treasure hunters. Not that we're looking for treasure, but we're looking for information, you know, knowledge, trying to piece together the past. And it's really hard to get these folks to talk to you because they think that you're looking for gold and they might have found something. They don't want you to know about it. So a lot of solid walls that you run into when doing this sort of thing, I'm sure you must have run into this as well.
Well, and even gaining the title as a treasure hunter. So they say you're a professional when you can make a living at something. And so there has been times in my life where I was considered a professional treasure hunter. Most of the time because the sites that people were willing to put the focus, energy, and finances into contain treasure that contain most of this real wild history. It's never just one thing. It's like the ultimate of whatever they had that they stashed would be records and the history and God knows what other items, you know, even ancient technology or whatever, and their value. So it all kind of runs together. The shame in it is when most of these things are being recovered by people who simply have a financial interest. So when all the historical, especially the off-the-wall stuff pops up, they're not going to mention it to anybody whatsoever. They'd rather see it destroyed so they can walk off with the value and currency, or the currency value of whatever they've discovered. So we tried to approach it from the backside. Part of my whole quest was for information and not to be led astray by the value, because we've been exposed to such high value. So I contributed most of the time my understanding and ability to decode ancient script and topographical layouts and monuments and things like that. Over a lot of years, I gained the ability to do that, which started back in the 80s, like we said. Mm-hmm. And even by the mid-90s, I was pretty prolific at it. And then, of course, really got intense because we did discover some high and big sites. And I mean, you know, and in the end, some, it's a curse if you find something too big when it comes to treasure stuff. We've done with all seven major three-letter agencies in the Gov, and we've been raided actually by all seven of them at one time with the National Guard. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that, besides the value, that they'd just rather keep a lid on, that's for certain. But it all kind of runs together. So some of, to get where we got, I mean, I had to do the work as a private consultant on different for great treasure groups that would basically pay me for doing the breakdown and pay me just right away for doing deep earth imaging and stuff like that. So we have equipment we can look in the ground 3D, 110 feet deep, and do materials analysis, tell between bone, wood, water, air, and beyond GPR basically. And and so we utilize this stuff as well. So I was able to not just read and decode the sites, but I was able to validate proof most of the sites with this imaging and other equipment. And so, but what it did is it got me to 100 or 200 sites over the years, and I was able to form comparative analysis between all of these and see all the similarities. So no matter who did it, there was always common aspects, and those formed keys, and those keys allowed me to kind of crack codes and simplify it to where you see the basis for why everyone does what they do. And then we just became really incredibly successful after that. And but I mean, it is true, depending on what you find, it can be too big. It can scare government, it can scare financiers, you know, it can evoke greed and responses like that that are so beyond it that you know, just shuts everything down. And that happens quite a bit too. So
I would think that if you ran into something that was potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars, you see it in the movies all the time. And Kathy and I have encountered this in the Andes, having discovered things that were potentially, you know, could make you quite wealthy, let's say.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point to where you're really wealthy. You know, we just walk away from it, but we're not there looking for that anyway. But I would imagine that in that situation here in the United States, you've got a lot of greed and avarice, and I'm sure people, there's a risk of personal injury or death if you happen to come across something and this one person doesn't want anyone else to know about it, and they're going to take it for themselves. Have you ever run into that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I had to tell a guy it was going to gut him like a fish if he didn't let me walk away one time over there by Wickenburg, Arizona, for that reason. So he invited me out, told me he'd pay me to break a site. Once I broke the site, he thought he would just whack me and then have the secret of the site. So, yeah, it happens. His name is Jerome. But as you can see, I'm sitting here talking to you. So,
yeah. I'm glad that it turned out in your favor.
Wow. Yeah. But, I mean, those situations are really real, and it gets worse. I mean, it even gets worse. So,
Worse than death? Wait a minute. Worse than death?
Well, I mean, in a sense, yeah. You know, you can be under mountains of pressure. You can be kidnapped. You can be tortured. You can be, you know, and then killed slowly, forced to show them where it is and then be buried in the hole that stuff was put in.
Oh, dear.
All those things occur, and I've had friends and cohorts and stuff that have experienced pretty well all that. I've had a lot of death threats, and I've had threats even from three-letter agencies, but I try to play with the game within a certain level and a realm, and that's that. So, I mean, but you really can't stop. It's like, you know, surfing or anything else. You don't stop surfing because, you know, what's under the water. You do the best you can to get around it. It's just what you do. That's what you do.
So what is the interest in these alphabet agencies? I mean, it certainly isn't the value. It's got to be something else, I'm thinking. Am I right?
Well, I mean, one, we had the Department of Economic Security was part of the entourage that raided us. So, you know, when you're talking value, so one of the last big ones that I was involved in that I was actually, we were the finder. We broke it down. We did the science. We did the excavation. We did everything, proofed the site. And we didn't have problems until we had an independent third party groups come in and do scanning and as well take it to other laboratories in the U.S. to have all the analytical work done on the results. And when it came back that the estimated site value at that time in 2010 by then, or 2008, I believe, by then it was valued at $40 billion.
Really?
That's enough to buy some countries. Yeah, there was an estimate in excess of 300,000 300 tons. So,
of gold?
Of smelted. And then there was also native gold, a tremendous amount that was there as well. And it's the second time it's only ever been seen in coal. And we deciphered the site straight from, you know, the symbols that were on the surface and excavated and pulled, recovered probably the world's largest Spanish colonial tool collection, stuff that's only mentioned in the 1541 book, D. Ray Metallica. We have them in our collection. The only other view of those tools and those items are in the pages of that manual written for the King of Spain. So we came out of there quite prolific. But the thing is, though, I mean, our dig budget was $1 million, and it was, we expected it to go to $10 million by the time that we did recovered. And after 320,000 or so, it was spent on the initial phase, which was mostly archaeology, heavy excavation, proving the site with technology, and taking us to the point to where we'd have to then open a shaft filled with hydrogen sulfide under pressure, which was phase two. And because, I mean, there was enough just in the vertical shaft alone, not even the side tunnels and rooms, to kill anyone within a mile of the area up to 30 foot tall. That's how big of a cloud just the vertical shaft would make that was fatal. So you couldn't just pop the lid or whatever. And at that point, really, the investors, once it was proved, the investors themselves got together and tried to eliminate as many people as they could because they didn't want to share this massive amount of money. And they tried to reduce us so far down that it was laughable. And it kind of tried to screw us out and hired other excavation teams. And of course, they came in and quit digging because they had never seen anything like that. And this guy ran his own heavy equipment company for 40 something years. And he said he wouldn't even touch the ground till we were back on site. So, but since they had pulled what they pulled, we actually shut that dig down. And it still sits in situ to this day, proven. And we pulled quite a bit of gold. We pulled it both native. We pulled, but we were mining. We didn't have a mining mineral rights, so we didn't collect the native. But we did also find smelted gold and quite a bit of really neat things. Steel alloys that were way too heavy and for being what they are. And then it comes back that they're actually, they have iridium in them, but they don't have the natural amount of iridium like a meteorite would have. And they also have strontium. So they've got rare earths added to the steel, and then they're folded like a laminate, like a Japanese sword. And we recovered quite a bit of stuff like that. So it was like little Area 51. You know, I mean, it was actually quite beyond and more advanced than they give them credit for in those days in the New World.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar or not, but we interviewed John and Myra Nichols down in Tucson. They wrote a book about the Roman crosses, but what they have spent the past at least a decade looking into is who was here prior to the Spanish being here.
Yeah.
And the information that they presented with proof, I mean, it wasn't as though it's like they're just saying it. They had proof that there was a hell of a complex civilization in the Tucson area, a lot of mining going on for lead and silver and I guess gold as well.
Yeah.
But the area around Tucson was about 3 million strong around 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. So what we've found is the population in North America before the Spanish occupation was right around 110 million. And after their occupation, it had reduced about 90%.
Yeah.
So people don't like to admit what true slavery is like, but, you know, they liked kids better than adults in a lot of these made big installations because they couldn't get, the adults would live 2 weeks to 4 weeks, and the kids would live 6 to 9 weeks. And before they wore them out and killed them. So the kids would actually live longer working underground than the adults would. And so, I mean, that's just an expression of how they felt about them. I mean, your life is worth 2 to 3 weeks of work. And so that's how they saw the people as this unlimited resource they could just tap and kill.
Well, that's
and
the
people
Spaniards.
Don't realize that, but yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was Spanish, Portuguese, French, they were, yeah, all kind of involved in those. I mean, Spain didn't build and sail ships, really. If you really go check, it was all Portugal who did all that under contract. So
right. It's
not like everybody had big boats and helped. The Portuguese had them long before Spain ever walked up and said, let's go over there. You know, so actually the Portuguese have a long history of coming to North America along with, you know, many, many others. So.
Mm-hmm. Let me jump back for a second to this shaft you were talking about. Mm-hmm. You said if you opened it up, this gas would come out. What kind of gas is it?
H2SO4, so hydrogen sulfide. So one breath at 300 parts per million is fatal.
Is that naturally occurring?
Yeah, it can be. Yeah, but they take advantage of it. So they build traps, and the traps can be many forms: water, acids, and things like that. Arsenic. In powder form, so you can walk on it, absorb it through your skin, breathe it. You know, quite a bit of other stuff. They'll grind up, the ones out of South America, and the Jesuit priests learned they could grind up mummies from South America, and then they took that powder, and that powder was highly infectious and very fatal. And, you know, some modern scientists have run into that, and even these days, can have a hard time if they can cure it. So there's, you know, aside from traps, you know, made of boulders and leveraging massive parts of mountains, and they did all the above.
Wow. My mind is racing. I was talking to a father and son team from Canada. They kept wanting us to go with them into Bolivia. They, you know, the death road in Bolivia.
Yeah.
Along that, there is a canyon that shoots off towards the east. And they said, we go back this canyon, be prepared to be gone for about 3 weeks. And where they're going is this place that they discovered that's where the top of a small mountain had been completely removed. And in its place, there was this huge building made of all of these big stones that was in the shape of a cross. And over the years, dirt, weathering, and so forth, it's not as distinctive. But inside of this cross, which was hollow, there was this fabulous treasure. And I'm thinking to myself, this sounds like a really interesting thing. They wanted us to come and film it, to do a documentary about it as they're going in to open it. We didn't know the whole story at the time, which would mean we wouldn't go because it's dangerous as hell. Probably would not have come out of there alive. But they warned us that when you go inside, because they'd gotten to the point where they looked inside, there was this powdered, powdered arsenic, I think? Some sort of powdered something that mercury That's what it was. That you go in there, it gets on to you, it absorbs into your skin. You're not going to really, I mean, so much of it that you're not going to survive. But they said that the one thing that really got them excited, well, two things really, was that they saw that it was part of the treasure of the Knights Templar. And the other is that there was a Madonna and child that was life-size. The eyes of the Madonna were just one diamond for each eye. The eyes of the child were a pair of sapphires. And the whole bust was made of gold. And it was solid. And that was the beginning of what was in this place. And they wanted us to come along and film going in and doing all of this. We didn't, of course. We come to find out that it's in Bolivia, and the Bolivian guard army guards this place. You don't get in. Yeah, that's about as much as I know about it, but I kind of know roughly where it's at. But they said it was part of the Knights Templar's treasure. Have you run into any Templar treasure in the Southwest in your journeys?
Yeah, matter of fact, on a lot of these sites, they seem to have activity and even things buried that predate the European involvement. And when I say the European involvement, I mean the involvement that started around the 1150s and up through the 1260, and the first revolt that happened around 1360 that hardly anybody's even heard of. So pre-1100s, but yeah, there was a lot actually of stories that related to the same thing. We see the some of the real early Spaniard accounts, but of finding previous things, like everything from ruins that were destroyed by a catapult and things like that, where the Native Americans related, like when they got into the area south of Santa Fe and the first expedition that rolled in there. It's recorded. You can go redo the research, and it says, you know, they got information from a boy. They tortured and killed one boy and made the other one tell him that where they could stay that was safe, and he took him to a ruin that had been raised to the ground and said it was all off limits so no one would see him there. And when they rolled in there, they recognized that the place had been flattened by a European catapult attack, and that the round rocks in excess of 100 to 200 pounds had been thrown with such a force that they went through two and three rock wall or built rock rooms before they'd go all the way into the courtyard of the ruin. And so they said that they felt that they knew who had done that, and it had something to do with the early French. And as well, the native boy said, yeah, they left tracks like you, and pointed to their cart tracks. So these were obviously Europeans that were here before Spain's first expeditions rolled in, who had already been having some interaction. Of course, we have found Templar name dates that are 1311 and 1308. So 1307, they were run off the African coast, basically. And there was, you know, they had 60,000 of them directly, and 60,000 directly, 900,000 people in their overall employment worldwide. As far as China and everywhere else. So when they got chased off the African continent, you know, everyone says, oh, well, they went into France and they just became farmers. Well, 60,000 people just didn't walk into France, and plus the almost other million that was under them. So a lot of them apparently came to North America, and they were here within a year into the central part of North America already registering their name dates. And from what we can see, they also, you know, Humboldt County in Northern California, they have what they call a Jesuit name code that had been lost for 70 years. They refound that in the early 90s. So a Jesuit had been up there in like 1160. And then and we have a feeling that they were the same group with the Templars. So it was the same choreography, basically, to come to the New World. You needed the people that had the knowledge of astronomy and all the sciences and everything. And a lot of these early priests did. So everyone was kind of involved on the backside. And so what we see historically is we have three major ruins in New Mexico that are Abo, Quarry, and Gran Quivira. And none of those are Native American, and they all date from around the 1200s. So they were actually destroyed around the 1200s. And I think maybe as late as 1350 or something. And the natives up there told me that they did take everybody out, and the nature even took part in it, because it destroyed, like Abo was destroyed by a blast of fire from above. And in the modern archaeology, when they went and excavated it, there was people inside when it had happened, and they were all standing looking skyward when the ceiling came down, and which is really off the wall. But in that place, we know a heritage because Adolf Bandelier mentions on his trip into New Mexico looking for a lot of these weird sites for J.P. Morgan and them. And you can find this in Adolf Bandelier's journals, or the journals of Adolf Bandelier. And then he has his secret writings, which they call, majority of it is gibberish, which is mean it's code, letters to Morgan that are held in Santa Fe that they won't let anybody take a look at. But what Bandelier relates just right off the bat is he went to Abo looking for a large man-sized stone Maltese cross that was inside the main ruin at Abo. And that when he got there, they knew it was there in 1837, and when he got there in 1880, it was gone. And he assumed that the people they call the Texans, which further research reveals is a group called the Knights of the Golden Circle, they were actually the group fundamental in starting the Civil War. So they were the remnant group that was searching this stuff back out again after America came back in, which is why they built Fort Union and made the seat of the Confederacy in Santa Fe, New Mexico, of all places, and why the first shots of the Civil War were actually in Glorieta, New Mexico. They were over some of these early found things and whatever. So.
Wow. I had no idea about that. Well, you know, I think that, you know, there were people who knew that these vast treasures existed in the Southwest, but they were usually, in my opinion anyway, I think they were people that had wealth or power or both, and usually back then wealth and power went hand in hand. But you have the churches, and then you have the monarchies, and they're looking to really enrich their coffers one way or the other. You know, I've heard stories from the Navajo Nation where there's, you know, dozens of bars of gold, huge bars, not just little small bars, but like long ones that are buried up there on the mesas that they killed the Spaniards, and they took the gold and they buried it because it was evil and they don't want any part of it. It's buried and it's going to stay there. And I'm sure there's a lot of that that went on, because from what you're telling me, they were enslaving the Native Americans and using them as their workforce.
Well, I'll tell you, this is a way you can maybe conceive what they did. And it'll also reveal to you that they probably could not have done this by themselves, like the Spanish occupation. So the first boats that went back, when Pinta and Santa Maria were here, the first one that returned had smelted gold on board. Everybody that's a prospector and a miner knows that's impossible. There's no way in hell they came over here, found, and made good of a resource to the point they could smelt a shipload of bars and take it back. So what that indicates is they've discovered a cache that was already here.
Right.
When we know that Caesar brags, and this is funny because he has to give credit to the Celts here, where Caesar doesn't like to give, or Rome doesn't like to give credit to anybody but themselves, even though they were the lesser of most of the people they conquered. But he brags about burning the Celtic fleet of ships in 55 BC. Okay, so, and it's, you can do the research on it. And he says the boats were so large. See, normally these stay out to sea, and then ships would go out to them and offload and trade with them. They don't even bring them in because you can't navigate them. And so but Rome was getting real nasty at that point in time and bulldogging everybody. And I mean, you're going to go back and find that we looked at, where did the Minoans go, and where did the Celts go, and where did the Basques go, and where did the guys from Fontainebleau in southern France go that made all the big rock carvings? Where did all these people go? Well, there was mining operations going on in the New World. And Spain, and from since 800 BC, the Celts have been running their worldwide trade network and going all of them down the coast of the New World and picking up and dropping off people and goods. So when Rome, I mean, it's and it's logical. It doesn't take a lot to get to here. So Rome burnt their fleet. Well, he said that his biggest boats that he could put one on end and still not reach the deck of the Celtic boats. And the only reason he gave them credit for their size was because he burned them out. So, which is what they did. They even talk about a catapult they had to develop with a high-speed winch and a metal hook to cut their rigging. So this is a big deal. And the Celts had tried to pull in there and blockade the Roman Navy, basically. But what happened by doing that is they cut off a world shipping network. So it burned the entire Celtic fleet, which stranded everybody in the New World in 55 BC. That's why, like, Barry Fell, a Harvard professor, Barry Fell, wrote America BC, and they find all the Ogam script and the Punic script and Nordic script, and they find all types of different from the Carthaginians and the Turkish. And it's funny because they'll be speaking their own tongue when they write, but they'll write it in a different language and a poor use of it, to where it looks like maybe they even learned it on the boat on the way over here. These things are all exist, and they don't fit in standard history, but they do, and you just compile it together. So when everyone's looking at, oh, Egypt had big boats and Rome had big boats, man, people have had ships. I mean, big ships for a long time. And they don't really ever mention that in history. So they'll relate to us about the destruction of it, but not the implication of that destruction. So you don't have ocean going boats that are 200 foot just up to the deck. These are 800 foot boats and more. And where are these going? What are these doing? And it represents an industrialized societies just to have the boat builders. These were the Celts. They were not, pagan was a name made up by Rome. These were some of the most advanced construction and metallurgists and boat makers in the world. Of course, not once they were erased from history. We're not related to that anymore. But what we see in the New World is the evidence of all those things. Even the people from Libya, from the West Libyan desert, who they see the remnants of them. They even had carts thousands of years ago, and these people vanished. But yet we have the same script in the Zuni over here in New Mexico, and we have the same script on rock and everything else as those Libyans. But those Libyans don't exist in history or in recorded history over there in North Africa. We don't know. We just have their rock paintings and their dwellings. But yet here we go. We have a better record of them here in North America. The same thing goes for a lot of the Celtic monuments with Ogam. We have more Ogam in North America than they do in Europe. We have more monumentation and stone construction, but not the deep cultural heritage type, like Stonehenge and things like that, as much. Because they came over here as industrial families and colonists in 800 BC, let's say, the starting. So the place was never secret. You know, when people say, oh, they discovered the New World, who said it was ever lost? I mean, it was just lost according to the Euro doctrine that was being taught as religion at that point in time. And then we never changed that, or we never altered it. So we're still actually just preaching religious doctrine, not evidential science. The Book of Ballymote is one that is referred to in America BC, and that's a book that was found in Ireland in a monastery. The book was, the first time it was known about was in the 1100s. So it contains a lot of different languages, and they're all set down like a cipher to where you can compare them and read them against each other. And it starts with Ogam, and it actually has Egyptian and a bunch of others. So, but what's unique about it is has most of the North American script is also in that book. And it was discovered in the 1100s in Ireland in a monastery. So you're looking at, they already knew all the script and comparative analytical linguistics of that script and the world script in the 1100s. You can't do that without traveling all over the world, period. So,
sure.
You know, it's basically self-evident, I mean, by this point.
Well, and I think there's been quite a concerted effort to keep history within a certain level of parameters. And why, I really don't know. Do you have any idea why that would be?
Yeah, and it does stem down to the same word everyone knows, control. I mean, in the end, some. And then it's the same thing as anything else. It's like I tell people, they say, well, why would they lie? And it's not that why would they continue to lie? And it's never that. It's like, why does a liar ever tell his second lie? And it's usually just to try to cover up the first. So when you've been doing that for eons since day one, and you're trying to put yourself so you feel important and you're a part of the history, which a lot of the British history and early British explorers and discoverers and who they claim are scientists, a lot of them did that. It was just as much ego as it was anything else. So they'd write in their personal perceptions, and then that's become our science. And it's never been revised, you know, so where does that leave you as far as with the powers that be? You know, they've got so many years of this and justifying it and tweaking the information, hiding the information, dustifying the information. You get so many years of that that now you can't let it go. It's like the kind of lie you can't live up to, you know.
Well, and part of our early investigations was taking a look at the giants. And there's been such an effort to keep the reality of the giants completely hidden, to the point, you know, where threats and innuendos being made, if you happen to even find something like that, you're in big trouble. We went through that. Have you found any references to the giants at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So you see them a lot in the ancient glyphs and depictions. And then we see more so with all this stuff, we actually see the physicality of it, which would not necessarily be giant skeletons, but the remnants of things that the giants did. So like giant tools, for example, we have quite a few giant-sized tools, and I could have had half a truckload of them. I mean, because we found an area that looked like it was for trade, and giant tools were stacked in stacks of like, make, and manufacture. And they're identical to what Native American tools use, just 3 to 5 times larger in rock scale. It may not have been a person 3 or 5 times larger, but as far as the pieces and the scale of the pieces, they certainly are. And it's neat because they'll be identical nap for nap. I mean, identical, but just so big that nobody can use them, you know. So that kind of stuff. So we have found that. And we found areas, of course, where it fits the type of cultural standard and cultural application and construction or site manufacture that fits the giant tales from, you know, other locations. So
we were following a story when we lived in Jerome of a giant that the miners found in a cave up above the, I forgot the name of the river there, but it's just right, you know, really north and a little west of Jerome, Sycamore Creek, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. But the giant was found, and with it, it had like a cannon. Well, they called it a cannon. It was a personal weapon this fellow would have carried. And, you know, it was in the 1800s. We tried as we could. We finally wanted to get to where the cave was to at least investigate that. But it's owned by the mining company now, and you're not allowed to go on that property. They wouldn't give us permission. But we did find the newspaper article in a mining journal. Anyway, that we thought that was really quite a find, and we've heard other people say that they found remarkable things up Sycamore Canyon as well. Did you ever go into Sycamore Canyon?
Yeah, I've been in that area and quite a bit all over that whole place. So from Bumblebee all the way up to almost Flag, we've been on that side. I wheeled most every four-wheel drive access with Southwest four-wheel drive way back in the day. And as well, you know, we've explored a ton of it. So we've even done DeSoto Mines. And that's one I don't think anyone has ever properly explained who mined it. You could fly, I've been in a room in there with no exaggeration, you could fly a Cessna aircraft in a circle inside one room underneath the Bradshaw Mountains there. It's called DeSoto. And like they train out of Phoenix there, they take all the mine guys, and for their final stages of mine rescue training, they take them into the upper levels of DeSoto. And when we described where we were going, they said that, you know, you call us, there's no way in hell you're ever getting any of us to go down there. And you guys are there. Period. And I mean, I've been 11 hours one direction down in there and seen things that and scale of mining that I almost couldn't comprehend. And I've been in hundreds of ancient mines. And but like I said, stuff in there that you can't comprehend. Room so big you could literally fly a Cessna around it. And so deep that the tailings you're on the side, you can shine high-powered lights down, and they just go off into blackness. And you could shine a light down that you know you can see a half mile. They still just return into blackness. Spaces that are just that massive. Rocks. There's one place where there's a rock the size of maybe your average McDonald's, or no, 4 of your average McDonald's, hanging out of the rock, and they have it cribbed in with trees that are 4 feet thick. And this is in the Bradshaws. Where in the world did the Bradshaws ever have trees 4 feet thick? but they have it cribbed in with trees that massive, holding a rock that massive. And then to get to the tunnels we went in, they actually had cables eye bolted in the bottom of this giant rock that's hanging out of the ceiling. And then you'd walk on these big 6-inch thick, foot wide planks that were 20 feet long, hanging from a cable on each side. And they would go one after another, hanging across this expanse so deep that you couldn't get a return back when you shined a light down. Stuff like that. I mean, I've never even seen anything like that in anybody's videos in my life, you know. But who did all that? And copper and gold would have been the primary out of there, mostly copper. But it's enough volume to rival some of the big open pit copper mines. It's just underground. Those the Bradshaws are hollow, basically. I mean, the ceilings on them are anywhere from 100 to 300 to 1,000 feet thick. And then the rooms inside are basically just like hollowed mountains.
And you never got to its deepest point ever?
Not even. No, we went 11 hours down and not even. Yeah, and I got arsenic poisoning so bad in there that it took 3 years to get over it. And we were going through tunnels that were blue with white fuzz. And then they had gold veins in them, a half inch to an inch wide. Beautiful, because everything else was oxidized out and growing. So silver was glowing, these black fuzzy clumps. But the gold veins were just clean because they don't oxidize. And
right.
The rest of the walls were basically deposited sulfuric acid, and that's what we went down there for, actually, because those crystals don't exist on the surface, and the only place you can get them is down in like that. But the acid was so thick that it looked like a fog in front of us, and so it was all arsenic, sulfuric acid, heavy metals, and nobody.
The ancient people had used that. That's why it was there.
Well, no, the sulfides leach out into the tunnel, but it shows the age of the tunnel. So you can have a high sulfide tunnel, and in 100 years, you'll get some growth and a little bit of color showing up on the walls. But some of these tunnels were so old that you couldn't see any exposed rock at all. It was just all blue cumulus or cloud, like chalcedony, cloud-like formations of crystals with big white puffballs with up to like 6-inch fur, and that's arsenic, and then big black puffballs, and that was the silver. And so, I mean, I've never even seen tunnels like that in pictures anywhere, you know. But it's because of the extreme age. They're just so old that they've grown that much mineral on the inside.
So do you suppose this goes back before the Great Flood? I mean, how do you come to reckoning this?
No, I would take it probably, and because I'm a little bit biased with our other supplemental research over the years, but I would say anywhere from 9,000 years to about maybe 2,000 years ago. So I think most of the activity went on during that duration, and I think that there was a couple of large spikes in that activity.
I see. God, to mine something out like that, the tailings, did they carry the tailings out, or how did that work?
Well, that's the thing, is you don't see as much tailing out there as, well, not near. I mean, the tailing piles would be absolutely massive. It'd be as big as the mountain. You don't see that. So how much copper was there versus what else was there, I don't know. But there's no, when you go in, there's definitely no way to justify where the tailings went or where they got processed.
Yeah, we ran into something like that in Cumbamayo in Peru. I might have told you about this. They dug these phenomenal canals through the mountains in solid granite and basalt. I mean, the workmanship is just unbelievable. And yet, you might get so caught up looking at all this, it goes on for miles and miles. But one of the things that occurred to me was, I don't see any of the debris from where they made this. There would have to be, for what we saw, there'd have to be some, you know, a lot of debris. And I mean, it's like they took the side of a mountain and made it flat, and then made the floor flat, and then carved down a canal. And it might be, you know, a few meters deep, and it was always 1 to 1.5 meters wide, perfectly smooth. But you didn't find any debris, and that just always through me. It's how on earth did they do this, and what did they use to do it with?
Right.
And it sounds like the same situation with this mine you're talking about.
Yeah, and we've seen evidence of like heavy rock lifting and things that even, that, you know, no European would have ever had the technology or knowledge. I mean, stuff that doesn't rival Baalbek. It's not finished block, but we've seen manipulated stone in excess of 5,400 tons. So they definitely had understandings that were far and above, you know, what they had later even. They lost that ability, obviously.
Can't help but wonder who these people might have been.
Right. And we've found enough of them. And, you know, like the information I sent to you today, you know, we can actually close that gap, I think, just with common logic and not a lot of inference. It's starting to reveal itself overall. And we've been fortunate enough to find some of the things that I think are going to close that gap.
Let's take another step backward farther into time and maybe into more of the paranormal. When it comes to, you know, exceedingly ancient places, have you found anything that's just really, really old that's completely unexplainable?
Yeah, 8 to 10,000.
Well, maybe, you know, even older than that.
In North America, not so much. And the reason I say that, now there is some stuff we found that probably is pre-flood that was re-monumented on the surface. So basically what is there is underneath the flood sediment and debris. And yes, we have stuff, even advanced technology that, you know, burn your equipment up in your hands and the whole nine yards. I mean, really, really hot stuff. And I believe that those are items and materials, objects, devices, whatever, that were our pre-flood technology. But the surface of this continent, you know, they call it Turtle Island for a reason. That's what a lot of the Native Americans talk about it as. And when you talk about a lot of the emergence stories, you know, the ground's all covered in mud. And when we look at the dates of what is here and compare that to what's in South America and other places around the world, it looks like somebody here just kind of took an eraser of sites pre-flood and just erased them off the map. And that's largely because this continent was subsided for the most part and raises and lowers. If you go by what Native Americans, how they describe it, this continent, Turtle Island, it raises above the surface. It lasts that way for a while. It dips largely below the surface. So whatever was here on the surface here is probably buried in tremendous amounts of sediment. Estimates have been 1,700 feet to 20,000 feet of sediment and hardened sedimentary rock sits on top of whatever was here pre 12,000 years ago, let's say. And so what we see is basically the remnant of that history. We don't see anything advanced. Let's say stone cities, stone cut, stone blocks, things like that up here, because this place was washed completely clean, subsided and covered. And that's what we see the evidence of. So a lot of the sites, I would say, so we have, like I've shown you in pictures, we have sites that are a culmination of histories and locations from other global places, and they start somewhere around 10,000 years ago. And then they have the same aspect of the cultures in other areas around the world 10,000 years ago. So the conclusion of that would be that they either moved around and spread that information all within the first couple of thousand years after the end of the major glacial period. In a very short period of time, they were global and everyone was already doing it, or that there was a commonality before the event. And so we believe that commonality existed as a global information system before the event. And so what we see is, like other places in the world, except with here, that nothing that was here remains from before that time. Like when we look at Baalbek or Pumapunku or anywhere else, what you can tell even with Pumapunku is that was blasted by a massive event. And those blocks, if you dug that valley up, there's probably those blocks scattered all over that valley in that dirt. Because when we look at how the in-situ positions just from photographs, I've never been there, but it's easy to see that the blocks themselves are distributed equally in the dirt at different angles and things like that, and then they excavate them. And they're basically floating in the strata. They're not all laying on a base or anything like that, which means that they were tumbled instantly and set down instantly over a really vast area. So any big, big things that were hit here were hit so violently and with so much material and subsidence of land and thrusting that nothing made it. And so even like Baalbek and stuff, you have the big blocks there, and obviously somebody repositioned them and put them back to use. And of course, as well, they sit in odd positions, and they even have dirt under them instead of being on a solid base. They got dirt under them. Mm-hmm. So it tells you something occurred that put that dirt there. And so I think North America was just basically scarfed just about clean, except for the places it was buried really, really deep.
This concludes the first hour of our broadcast. The full show is over 4 hours long and includes over 70 never-before-seen images our guest used to illustrate important details few have been exposed to. You should hear the entire show. I encourage you to support the Jerry Will Show. With your support, you may listen to or watch the full show with Robert Kreider and many others that are available in our archives. Visit jerrywillsshow.com. That's jerrywillsshow.com. You can join for as little as $2 a month. Becoming a member is easily done. Because you're listening to this on your favorite podcast resource, please give us a like and a comment. It means a lot to us when you do this. Thanks for listening, folks. We hope you enjoyed this broadcast.